Welcome to the Curry Chronicles podcast. And now, here is James Curry.
Glenn Plaskin is a well-known author and celebrity journalist. I first met Glenn a few years ago when the two of us collaborated on a book project. We've maintained a friendship ever since. I recently sat down with Glenn in his New York City apartment to discuss some of his A-list interviews, including his 11-hour chat with Donald Trump, and the strange way he started his career. Here is part of that conversation.
From the time I was in kindergarten until I was in 12th grade, there was this shadow over me, which was I knew that I was different. Now, in those days, there was no such thing as using the word gay, really. And of course, a child who's 6 or 7 or 8 isn't sexual in that way. But nevertheless, apparently, I was different because these little son of a bitch little boys certainly knew it and were very punitive about
it. So how, you were feminine?
I don't know, because I couldn't see myself, you see. But they knew that I wasn't athletic. You know, I wasn't as boisterous as they were. I don't know what it was, but I was very quiet. I was highly sensitive, and I knew I didn't fit in. I knew it from the time I was 5. And the only reason I mention this is because as my schooling progressed, this became it's almost like post-traumatic stress syndrome. It became a burden for me to carry because I carried it secretly. I never told my mother, my father, or anybody that people were beating me up. They were calling me names. You know, I was like humiliated in gym class. Nobody wanted me on their team. I mean, it's really humiliating for a child. There was no teacher who helped me. There was nobody. And I emphasize this because children keep these things secret. And what I did is I figured unconsciously, this was subconscious, that I needed to find a way to feel better about myself in some way. So I was very comedic. As I grew older, I became comedic. I developed my musical talent. But by the time I was in 5th grade, the principal one day brought me into the office with my mother. And he told her, he said, "I'm really sorry, but your son has a very low IQ. But garbage collectors can be happy too."
He actually said those words?
Yes, he did. And I remember my mother slapping me. I think she slapped me. And years later, I wrote a column when I became a national columnist, you know, for the New York Daily News, and my stuff was syndicated by the Tribune Company. I wrote a column that was inspirational called Turning Point. And every week I would have a different celebrity talk about a turning point in their life that affected them and how they got over it. Well, when this thing came out as a book, when this turning point thing came out as a book, which was on Oprah, the last chapter in the book is about me. Now, I'm not a celebrity, but I told the story about how damaging it was to be told you were stupid when you were in 5th grade. And
did your parents call you stupid?
No, never, never, never. In fact, I wasn't stupid at home, but for someone to tell a child you have a low IQ is not a good thing to do. And this story was published, and I said, you know, I recovered from this. I went on to, you know, 9 years in a conservatory of music and the doctoral level. Then I went on to write 7 books and hundreds of interviews with news-making people. So when this article came out, and I was very self-revealing about how bad I felt about myself, I got a letter a few days later in the mail from Katharine Hepburn, the actress, who had read the article I wrote. And all she said was, "Good for you."
In her letter, that was it?
I have it in the other room. She said, "Good for you." It's on the wall in there. And it's a good reminder that if your child isn't doing well in school, or if your child seems unhappy, I think you have to go a little deeper to find out what was wrong. So in my case, the only way that I seemed to be able to feel good about myself was to develop some kind of a way that I could impress people somehow. So by 6th grade, my fingers were moving like fire. The kids in the school called me Fingers because I was at that point playing the piano. And by the time I was in 12th grade, all my D's and F's had migrated to A's and B's. And by the time I was a senior in high school, I thought I wanted to be a concert pianist. Now, in truth, I think I was wrong. But remember, I was looking for a way to find some self-esteem and accomplishment. And the only way I could think of doing it was through the piano.
Did you actually like music?
Oh, yes. I loved playing, but I did not like performing. It made me extremely nervous. Anybody looking at me performing, playing the piano made me extremely nervous. Talking doesn't bother me. Playing did. That should have been my first clue. But anyway, it was too late. I went to a conservatory of music for 9 years in a row. And I'll be honest with you, as good as I was, and I was good, there were many elements to my performance as a musician that were really good. I wasn't good enough to achieve what it is I wanted to achieve, which is what I thought I wanted, which was performing. Now, the truth of the matter is, as now that I'm looking back years ago, it was totally wrong for me. A, I didn't like performing in front of people. B, I hate traveling. And C, I hated the isolation of being in a practice room all day. How horrible, how isolating. So it turns out, when I was 25, I announced to my mom and dad, I'm quitting. They said, you're quitting?
You just like that?
You can't quit. We put all this money into your education. Remember, I was just about to get a doctoral degree, which would have enabled me to be a professor at a college. Like, I could teach other people how to play the piano, like as if I wanted to do that, right? So I had a gay friend who was my best friend in Baltimore. Remember, I was going to Johns Hopkins Peabody Conservatory of Music. And I told him, you know, the guys are much better looking in New York City than they are in Baltimore.
So were you open and out with your sexuality at that point?
Yeah. By the time I was in graduate school, that's when I came into my own. For the first time in my life, I had a group of gay friends. And remember, this was during the 70s when disco and Donna Summer were at their height. And every single night in Baltimore, we would go to the Hippopotamus Club, which was this big disco. I loved it. And you know, it was an adventure. You could go out every single night and meet a new guy if you wanted to.
That's still true.
And even if you didn't become intimate with him, you could just meet all these new people. So by this point, I was bored with Baltimore and very depressed about what I had done. Because what I had done was seemingly a terrible mistake. I had spent 9 years of my life preparing for something that I didn't want.
Was it wasted time?
No, I'm about to tell you why it wasn't wasted. That's the lesson in here. Because as you get older, you can see the fatalistic qualities of the decisions you made and why it happened, and everything happened for a reason. It turns out that had I not done all that work at the Conservatory of Music, I never would have come up with an idea for a book. It was originally supposed to be a doctoral dissertation, but it was turned down. My idea was to write a book about Vladimir Horowitz, who was at that time, you know, one of the most towering musicians of the 20th century. He was the highest paid musician in the world. He had just played at the White House. He was on 60 Minutes. I mean, he was to most people nowadays, they don't even know his name practically, but to anyone, you know, who was interested in classical music, it was like Pavarotti or someone like that.
So this was going to be your thesis?
It was, but it was turned down.
Did they say why?
It wasn't academic enough.
Right. Not enough research?
I don't know. All I can remember is there wasn't academic enough. Well, fuck academic. I went to New York City because for two reasons. I wanted to meet guys, and I wanted a new career. So I came to New York with no money, no friends, no job, nothing. But I came here with one thing, which was an idea. And why would I think I could write a book? I had never even written a college paper because, remember, at the conservatory, you don't write.
Yeah.
It's not a liberal arts education. So I came to New York.
Who did you stay with? Where did you live?
Well, when I got here, first I stayed with my cousin, and then after that I got an apartment. I sold my car. I had had a new car, and I sold it, and I lived on the money from the car for the first 6 months.
That was enough?
And I got a full-time job.
As?
At a concert artist management company. How ironic that I was trying to be a concert artist, but now how did I morph into a junior agent at a concert artist management company? I needed a job, and I got one. And I sat there for the next 6 months doing two things, trying to book concerts for their people and calling publishers. And I lied. Remember, when you have a vision, if you can imagine something, maybe you can get it. If you can't imagine it, you can't get it. Well, what I imagined, for whatever the reason, is that I was going to write a book, the first book, about the most famous musician in the world. That was my idea.
Mm-hmm.
I started calling up publishers. I called up Jacqueline Onassis at Doubleday, and she came on the phone. And I called up many others.
So you just called up and she answered, or
no,
they put you through
I
her?
I called up. I explained to the assistant who I was and what I wanted, and that I was writing. I didn't tell them I wanted to write a book. I told them I was writing a book. That's the difference. I never asked anything. I was announcing my presence, and I had the nerve to do it. And to make a long story short, I eventually got 15 publishers who were interested in the idea. Then I took my list to the William Morris Agency. The chief agent, his name was Owen Laster, and he handled people like James Michener and Barbara Walters and President Nixon and President Ford. He was the head of the literary department of the William Morris Agency. And he said, well, what have you written? I said, nothing. He said, well, what have you had published? I said, nothing. He said, then what do you have? I pulled out my list. I said, this is what I have. 15 publishers who want to publish my book.
And that part was truthful.
It was all truthful. And he said, well, where's your book proposal? Well, honestly, I didn't know what a book proposal was at the time. I said, oh, do you need one? He said, yeah. So I left. I went to the Lincoln Center Library. I don't know how I did it. All I know is I took out a huge clip file, because in those days, nothing was on microfilm.
Right.
And I went through the whole thing until I found one thing in there that I thought I could write about, which was a nervous breakdown he had followed by a triumphant return at Carnegie Hall. I thought that would be dramatic. So after that, I wrote the book proposal. Don't ask me how, because I couldn't tell you. But I took it back to the William Morris Agency, and I slapped it on his desk. I said, here it is. And I said, I want you to sell this for $50,000.
You were that assertive?
Yes. And this was in 1979, when $50,000 was probably worth more than it is now. He said, well, I don't know if I can sell it. I said, you'll sell it, and I want $50,000 minimum. I don't know how I knew that number, but I did. Well, on my birthday in 1979, he sold it for $50,000.
Oh, wow.
To a major New York City publisher, William Morrow, and it was subsequently sold in England, Finland, France, Germany, Japan, and Canada. Well, suddenly, I had a book contract, but I didn't know how to write a book.
So what'd you do?
The point of this whole thing wasn't to write the book. It was to see if I could get a deal to write the book. Once I actually was faced with the reality of it, I thought, oh, my God. So the first thing I did is I hired a writing teacher. He was the program writer for the New York Philharmonic Orchestra and CBS Records.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a friend who'd been introduced to me through a friend. And I said, I'll write things, and you correct them. So I started doing it, and he was
okay with that?
Well, I paid him.
So he was your copy editor?
I would call him my editor, coach, writing teacher. And I knew I had to get something published to make myself credible. So I called up the New York Times Sunday Magazine editor, and I said, hello, I just got a book contract to write a biography of Vladimir Horowitz, and I'd like to write an article for you. He said, well, what's it going to be called? I said, we'll call it The Secret Career of Horowitz. And it'll be about his intimate relationship with his male piano students, some of whom he fell in love with and tried to seduce.
Mm.
I said, interested? He said, yeah. Well, that was the first article I ever had published in the New York Times Sunday Magazine. I always say to people, start at the top if you can. So after that, they hired me to write these profiles of classical musicians. And they would pay me $300 an article back then. But the price didn't matter, because I was getting exposure. And all during this time, which was over the next 3 years, I was writing this book. It wouldn't have taken that long had I known what I was doing. But I had many problems during that period. It was extremely difficult. The final result was the first book ever published about him. It was 450 pages. It had 2,000 footnotes. And I had a little team around me. I had one editor, and then I had another editor. I had a discographer, a person who put together the whole record, recording history of his life.
Provided by the publisher or?
No, it was all commissioned out by me. I knew I needed help. And I wrote the whole book. And when it was published, it was so exciting for me. Because remember, I would have been sitting in a practice room if I had just finished my degree. But mm-hmm. instead, I was sitting at the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Wow.
And I was put on a book tour all around the country. And suddenly the book is serialized on the front page of the London Times, the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune.
What does that feel like?
Well, it was a thrill. I really can't explain it. But it was a great feeling of accomplishment, and it was also extremely exciting and scary all at the same time. It's like when people make a dream come true, it's never exactly the way you think it's going to be, you know?
But was that your dream, or did it become your dream?
Well, my complete identity was attached to doing this book. That's all I could think about, basically. So when I did it, it wasn't that I had a dream to be a writer particularly. That wasn't really the point of it. It was that I wanted to do a story about him. I was just fascinated by him. Well, then when it was published, I had gone through hell to write it. It was very difficult, painful. I went to therapists. I was so depressed. I didn't think I could do it. I mean, I was riddled with insecurities about doing
it. Were you also still working your other job while this was happening?
No.
You quit that.
I had quit that. This was a full-time job.
So the $50,000 they gave you sustained you in New York City at mm-hmm. that time?
And when the book was published, I realized I didn't want to write another book. It was simply too painful.
Right.
So my agent said, what would you like to do now, write another musical biography? I said, oh, no, we're done with that. I said, what I want to do is meet people. Well, that's how my whole celebrity interviewing career began. Turns out that's what I really wanted to do. So, you know, my first interview was with Carol Burnett. And then there was Nancy Reagan. There was Elizabeth Taylor. There was Lena Horne. There was Michael Jackson and Calvin Klein and Joan Kennedy and Edward Kennedy and Bette Midler and Dolly Parton and on and on and on. And it turns out that I discovered a new talent I had, which had nothing to do with writing a book. Interviewing.
Mm. Is it fun for you to do that?
It was a lot of fun. It was scary in a way. But remember, I was now interviewing people for print media. And I started with Carol Burnett, and I worked my way onward. Eventually, I was hired full-time, you know, at one magazine, and then I was hired at a newspaper, the New York Daily News, and then eventually my articles were syndicated around the country. And what strikes me about this 10-year period, there was a 10-year period from the time the book was finished until the time the celebrity career was bookended, more or less. And it was nonstop interviewing. And I found that I had an ability to talk to famous people and to... I wasn't a, by any means, a reporter in the sense of a hard news reporter. I was a human interest reporter. My interest was in making psychological profiles.
Mm-hmm.
So I began to get a reputation for being someone who you wouldn't be afraid of because he's not going to slam you, you know. So
it's like a Larry King.
A little like that. So, you know, I had a two-hour intimate lunch with Diana Ross, I remember once. And during the lunch, she started to cry about something, and it had something to do with her disappointment about never having had her film career come to full fruition. She was so wonderful in Lady Sings the Blues, and then there wasn't too much after that. But I had intimate moments all over the place. I flew to London and had lunch with Joan Collins. I went to Switzerland and interviewed Audrey Hepburn. I went all over the place. I went to the White House twice to interview Mrs. Reagan, once after President Reagan was shot, and then 2 years later when we did Christmas at the White House. And I found that one interview led to the next.
But I do have a question about, you talk about social anxiety, which is I think what you probably have or had, but you still managed to overcome that to do all these great things. How?
Well, I'm a very insecure person.
Mm-hmm. But you're also determined, clearly.
But I'm also a very tenacious person and hardworking. So oftentimes my ambitions were ahead of my insecurities. I would be afraid. I remember specifically oftentimes going into the men's room, not because I had to go to the bathroom before interviews, but because it was the one quiet place I could sit before an interview. I remember doing that once before interviewing Meryl Streep. I would just calm myself. And I found that the scariest part was the anticipation. That's always the scariest part of doing anything new. Once you're actually in it and you're talking to a human being, it's amazing how, you know, you relax more. But when you're meeting someone face-to-face who's an icon like Katharine Hepburn or Nancy Reagan or any of these people who you've seen in the movies and on television, it is a little intimidating at first, and I would always try to break the ice. For example, when Elizabeth Taylor came down, we were in a duplex hotel suite in New York City at the Plaza Atene Hotel, and she came down the staircase to make her entrance to me. And she looked just like Elizabeth Taylor at this time. I mean, some people don't look as good in person as you expect them to be, you know, but she actually looked like a movie star, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And she came right up to me, and I said, "Oh," I said, "you have such beautiful skin." And she said, "Do you want to feel it?" And she took my hand, and she put it on her face. And I said, "What's your secret?" And she said, "Sesame oil." I said, "You're kidding." She said, "No, I put sesame oil all over my face." And then I looked down at her hand, and I said, "Is that it?" And I meant the Krupp diamond, which was this 33-carat diamond that Richard Burton had given her. She said, "Yeah, you want to see it?" I said, "Yeah." She just took it off her finger and tossed it over to me. And I was sitting there holding Elizabeth Taylor's ring. And it was kind of a very human moment. And then we had the next 2 hours talking about everything. At this time, remember, this is in the late 80s, the AIDS crisis yeah. is an absolute height.
Now, is that part of your strategy when you're interviewing a subject, or does that just happen naturally? Do you plan that stuff?
No. I plan all my questions mm-hmm. in detail, right. and I also sequence them so that I know where I'm trying to go. Because remember, with Elizabeth Taylor, I was covering four things. I'm covering her perfume tour. I'm covering the AIDS crisis. I'm covering her love life, and I'm covering her film history, and I'm covering her whole life. And I have to do it in an hour and a half.
Yeah.
So I have a strategy. But these spontaneous things are not planned, no. And then I remember, all I can remember is her shouting to me when I started talking about the homophobia rampant in the 80s about people who had AIDS and how none of the celebrities wanted to come out and raise money and raise awareness.
Well, that was near to her, wasn't it?
Well, Rock Hudson had died not long before this interview. So she told the whole story about Rock Hudson dying and about, and she, and I remember her talking about, she said, "The AIDS virus could have been brought to us by the goddamn green monkey of Africa. We don't know how it got in." She said, "As far as I'm concerned, some rich babe from Miami might have brought it in." She was trying to make the point that it's not a gay disease. You know, this was a virus that that insinuated itself into our country and into the world. And at this time, it was a gutsy thing to do, to say what she was saying. So I was sitting there with my tape recorder, and there I am sitting there in a hotel room with Elizabeth Taylor yelling at me about the AIDS crisis.
Did you ever have those moments where you thought, you know, that kid who was being made fun of in school, basically a loser, and now you're interviewing Elizabeth Taylor?
It was surrealistic. I feel the whole thing I'm describing to you is rather, it starts with a bad dream and then it becomes a happier dream. It's totally surrealistic. If you could go to college and somebody told you, "This is what I did to become a writer," they would look at you like you were nuts. He starts with a low IQ, gets D's and F's, never has any training as a writer, becomes a musician, hates doing it, has an idea for a book, gets a major book contract, takes 3 years to write it when he almost think he can't do it. Then the book is published, it's successful, and now I'm sitting in the White House. you figure it out.
Did you ever run into any of those people who made fun of you or who said you were stupid and say, look at me now?
No, I didn't. But I have to tell you, I was very lucky and fortunate. First of all, certain things happened my way, you know, certain luck happened. And if there was any revenge I got, it was by having all these articles published. And, you know, it's hard to explain the feeling you get when Oprah Winfrey does a whole show on one of your books. But there was one three-month period when I was on Oprah, Larry King, Sally Jesse Raphael, Geraldo, and Joan Rivers' show, all in the same few months.
Wow.
I always tell people, you know, if there's something you want to do, if I could do what I did with all the problems I had internally, then you could do anything. So I always tell people, you know, try to do it if you can. And what happened is, as my career progressed, I became more sophisticated in my knowledge. I mean, how did I interview Donald Trump, for example? This interview that I did in 1990 with him has, to this day, been out in the media as recently as the last 6 months.
You've kind of had a resurgence with that interview, right?
Who would have thought there'd be any life left in it?
Well,
right?
First, when did that first run?
It ran in 1990.
Okay.
And it made headlines back then for many reasons. It was one of the only times Playboy ever put a man on the cover.
Well, first, how did you meet Donald Trump?
Oh, well, I was on the Phil Donahue show, and I met him backstage in the December of 1988 at the Phil Donahue show. And he was just standing there alone backstage.
No entourage, no...
I don't remember anybody around him at that moment.
And you could just walk up to this billionaire.
I just walked right over to him. I said, Mr. Trump. I said, I'm Glenn Plaskin from the New York Daily News, and I want to do a cover story interview with you. I said, we got to set it up.
What was his reaction?
Oh, he's very friendly. He was very, you have to remember, his relationship to the press back then was quite different than it is now. He welcomed press, and he was mostly getting good press because he was a billionaire on the rise. So he said, absolutely, call my secretary, set it up. So I did. And the first interview happened in the January of 1989.
Now, this was for the Playboy interview.
No, that wasn't the Playboy interview. The first interview was a cover story in the New York Daily News. It was called The People's Billionaire.
Mm-hmm.
It was all about his life. And this precedes any of his marital problems, any of the tabloid thing that happened after that. It was just a straight interview with him that went on in his office for about 2 or 3 hours. And I have a magazine cover here that was never published. He had just bought Eastern Airlines, and he posed for the cover with a plane, and it was never used. And they used a different picture of him instead, so there was only one printed, which I have here, which he later signed. But anyway, we did this interview, got along fine, and then later that year, I said, I'd like to interview your wife, Ivana, because remember, she was the president of the Plaza Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And she was also running one of his casinos in Atlantic City. And I did a Christmas interview with her, a very glamorous interview.
Well, what's it like to interview Donald Trump?
Oh, he was very witty and affable and charming. And the first interview was, I don't remember that much about it, except he was mostly talking about his career. But the second interview, eventually when we got to the Playboy interview, the reason why it came back in the news recently is because many of his personality traits and policies are foreshadowed in the Playboy interview, and they're identical.
They haven't changed much.
To what they are now. For example, back then and now, he says foreign nations are ripping us off. Does that sound familiar? Back then and now, he talked about how China was taking advantage of us. Back then and now, he talked about being tough and not trusting anyone. Back then and now, he expressed his belief in extreme military strength. That was some, he had gone to military school himself. Mm-hmm. And back then and now, he talked a lot about nuclear war and how the greatest stupidity was people believing that it could never happen again. and back then and now. He also talked about the power of the counterpunch. All of these things that he was saying in 1990 were so current that the Prime Minister of Japan and the Chancellor of Germany read this interview recently to prepare for their meetings with Trump at the White House. And another interesting thing in that interview is that he said he believes in the power of positive thinking and negative thinking. Oh, everybody always bullshits you and say, oh, I believe in the power of positive thinking. But Trump didn't say that.
What does that mean? So we know everyone knows what the power of positive thinking is. What is the power of negative thinking?
He means you have to prepare for the worst. He suspects the worst in you.
So he doesn't trust anybody.
He has a very low level of trust. He's skeptical about people, and he questions their motives. So it says, quote unquote, he keeps his guard up 100% and that everything is a psychological game. Well, this idea that everything is a psychological game is very current. I think that's the way he often operates in the White House. And he said to me, I can be a killer or I can be a nice guy. This is a theme that he says constantly now. And he said, you have to be ruthless. And he also said that most of his decisions are more improvisational than you would think, which we also know from his current decisions. And then I finally asked him toward the end of the interview, are you happy? You have all this money. What does all this money mean to you? The planes, the mansions, the buildings, you know, the Plaza Hotel, which he owned, 3 casinos in Atlantic City. He said to me, they're all just props. They're props for the show. And I said, what's the show called? He said, Trump. So you see, he had a brilliant sense of merchandising even then. And he said happiness was not his goal. He said that he had something called control neurosis.
Is that a real thing?
Well, he made it up. He said it's having huge energy and an abundance of discontent. So in other words, nothing is enough. And even though, you know, he overextended himself during the 90s and later, you know, pulled his company back in and eventually became a TV reality star, which actually gave him the platform to run for president, I don't think the psychological motives that were running him are any different now than they were then. And so my experience with Trump was very positive. I mean, I spent a total of 6 weeks over a period of 6 weeks interviewing him, mm-hmm. more than 11 hours of tape. It's the longest interview he ever gave. It is hung on his wall in his Trump Tower office. And to this day, during political campaign appearances, people bring the magazine, they find it somewhere, and he signs it. So I never would have thought that this interview that I did that long ago would have resonated, you know, for this amount of time.
So what does that feel like to know that world leaders are using your stuff to research Donald Trump?
Well, it has nothing to do with me personally. At best, it has to do with, you know, the fact that I tried to be as probing as I could be. You know, Trump can be difficult. He was very different once the tabloid crisis hit. Remember when he left his wife, Ivana, eventually, and he had this affair with Marla Maples. I also had the only print interview that Marla Maples did at the time, and I got the interview from Donald Trump. I said to him, I want to interview Marla. He said, well, if you want to interview her, I'll set up a secret meeting for you. She'll have to meet you for a drink and see if she likes you. So we met at a hotel. She must have liked me because she did the interview, but because she was being so hunted by the media, he sent her down here to this apartment where we're talking today to do the interview here. And I'll never forget the day the doorman said to me, Marla Maples is here. I said, oh, send her up. And we did a long interview here, and it was published all over the place. And it was thanks to Donald Trump that I got the interview. But if you read the interview today, I must say, Marla Maples was quite an audacious young woman. Here she is having an affair. Here she is telling everyone that she's a religious girl from the South who goes to church, but she's having an affair with a married man with 3 children. And I confronted her with this fact quite aggressively. One thing about me is that I always would come off seeming kind of soft, but my questions could be very aggressive mm-hmm. if I wanted them to be, and I would build up to it. And I finally got her to admit that in her view, remember, she's a woman like around 24, 25 years old at the time, she said that Ivana didn't love her husband. She was only interested in business and socializing and getting the money. And she even had the nerve to say that she neglected her kids. This was incredibly audacious of her, and that only she could make Donald happy. Well, as we all know, the way the story turned out, I guess she didn't make him happy either, because she hit the dust a few years later. I mean, she did marry him. She had a child. They were divorced, and then he moved on. But I liked Marla Maples as a person at the time, and she had a lot of psychological insight. But if you read the interview now, it's really quite surprising how honest she was about her real true feelings about, in her view as a 25-year-old, how Ivana must have seemed to her. And to this day, as you know, Ivana Trump recently wrote a book, and she refers to Marla Maples as the showgirl, someone who she will never mention by name and who she will never forgive. And honestly, if I were in Ivana Trump's shoes and this girl comes along and steals my husband, I'm not sure I would be very interested in forgiving her either. So you could say I'm the only journalist out there who has interviewed Donald Trump, Ivana Trump, and Marla Maples multiple times.
Do you maintain a relationship with the Trumps?
I have a good relationship with Ivana Trump, and Donald Trump and I have stayed in touch over the years.
Who is your favorite interview subject?
Probably my most favorite was Katharine Hepburn, the actress.
Why so?
Well, I remember as a kid seeing her in that movie, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Remember that movie? When the pretty, waspy white girl brings home a black man who she's going to marry, Sidney Poitier, right? And I could never forget that scene in the driveway when Katharine Hepburn tells off the racist employee. She said, you know, you take your car, turn it around, and drive out. You're fired. And I could never forget that scene. So when my Horowitz book was published, I sent her a copy of the book as a gift. Don't ask me why. I just did it. I would often do that. If I had a book, I would send it to people that I admired. Well, one day the phone rang, and it was her. Hello, Mr. Plaskin. I said, yes, this is Katharine Hepburn. Well, I thought it was a friend playing a joke on me. I said, no, it can't be you. And she said, oh, it's me. And she said, I got your book in the mail. And she said, you know, my chauffeur in the 1930s was Horowitz's chauffeur. I said, you're kidding. She said, would you like to come for lunch? So I did. Now, how many times in your lifetime, you know, will you be invited by Katharine Hepburn to lunch? She said, ham and cheese Friday, 12:30, and hung up the phone. So I went to the, I was petrified, 244 East 49th Street. That's where I went. The door opened, and her maid answered, and I came up to the main room upstairs, and then she came down the stairs and made her entrance. They all make an entrance. Mm-hmm. She came right up to my face. She said, oh, my God, you look so young. I said, oh, thank you.
How old were you?
At the time, I was 32, but probably looked younger. So
that's my age right now.
I was your age, yes. Maybe you'll get an invitation.
Maybe.
To lunch. So, you know, we had lunch, and it was very exciting and talking about things off the record. This is not an interview, you know. But the reason why, you know, I always say it's the domino effect is because after I had this lunch, I subsequently did three interviews with her, one for her 80th birthday, another one when her autobiography, Me, came out, and another one when she did a TV movie with Ryan O'Neill. So every time I would go back, we knew each other, and she was very friendly. And then one day I said to her, would you like to meet Calvin Klein, who was a friend of mine and an interview subject? Oh, yes, I'd like to. So I invited him for a private lunch at her house, which I arranged. And I arranged another private lunch with Peter Jennings, all because she wanted to meet these people. And then during those lunches, they were off the record. I was just an observer. But I have to tell you, all this stuff I'm telling you was really surrealistic.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, whoa, where am I here? what am I doing? I actually oftentimes felt incredibly inadequate. I thought, well, who am I? Why do they want to talk to me? But for whatever the reason, I was able to do it. So I went with it. And I remember the last time I ever saw Katharine Hepburn, I'd had lunch with her, and we walked outside the gate of her house. And as we came out, people were staring at her. And she looked up at me and she said, you know, you look better than you used to. I said, Ms. Hepburn, is that a compliment? She said, you can take it however you like. And she walked away. And that was the last time I ever saw her.
Thank you for listening to the Curry Chronicles podcast. Be sure to follow us on the web at currychronicles.com. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook, and of course, subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. The Curry Chronicles podcast is hosted by James Curry.